Welcome to Hot Grease. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. This Heritage Radio Network program is brought to you by White Oak Pastures. White Oak Pastures cattle are raised in a manner that has stood the test of time. It begins with southern sunshine, unpolluted country air, and fertile coastal soil. The cattle are allowed to roam the pastures and graze freely on sweet native grasses all of their lives. White Oak Pastures all-natural grass-fed beef has been available in all of the Whole Foods stores in the Mid-Atlantic states. We hope that you will support their program through your purchase of their beef through one of those Whole Foods stores. For more information, go to whiteoakpastures.com. Every week on Hot Grease, we bring sustainability, local foods, and other forward-thinking schools of culinary thought to the minds and kitchens of everyday folks. Our conversations cover the entire spectrum of food enthusiasts, from renowned culinary masters to moms on a budget. Today, we'll be talking Shirley Sherrod and Danny Macaroons. As always, our live call-in number here at Heritage Radio Network is 718-497-2128. Damian M. Mosley is a food scholar and cook whose recent work has been published in Gastronomica, TheRoot.com, and Gastropolis Food in New York City. His food and research focuses on the way that food authenticates race. Mr. Mosley, welcome to Hot Grease.
How you doing?
I'm great.
Thank you for having me.
So, the sizzling news story of last week was Shirley Sherrod. And help me out. We're going to make sure we have all the key players for some of our listeners who might not have heard of the story. We have Ms. Sherrod herself. We have the USDA, right?
Right.
Secretary, are we gonna lump Vilsack in there? Secretary of State Vilsack.
Yeah, I mean he's a factor.
NAACP and Fox News. I'm gonna say other media, and I'm missing. I forget the guy's name. The idiot who did the clip, the blogger guy, the conservative blogger. I forget his name. What were your initial thoughts when you heard about the Shirley Sherrod story?
Wow. I'd say my initial thoughts were just that she got caught up. She got caught up kind of with New Age media, having said something that was recorded and then potentially taken out of context. I certainly didn't have the whole story in the beginning.
Yeah, I guess we need to go back for some of the listeners. If you're not aware, Shirley Sherrod was an employee in the Department of Rural Development for the USDA. She made some comments at a speech or a talk about a former job and something she did at a former job in helping a white farmer. The conservative blogger essentially took snippets of her speech and Fox News picked it up. They did not verify the entire speech and did not listen, or maybe they did listen to the entire speech. And to make a long story short, she was asked to resign. And the big question is, who asked her to resign? Was it the White House? Was it her initial boss? Or what? Shirley Sherrod's life's work has been around helping rural farmers, both black and white, in the South. What are your thoughts about decades of discrimination against black farmers?
I've got a lot of thoughts, and I guess I'll share this. Part of this is very personal to me because, in fact, my father worked for 30 plus years for the USDA.
Oh, wow.
And you're talking about a black man from small town Mississippi who started working for the USDA in 1969, oversaw and audited programs like WIC and food stamps, and did a lot of investigations throughout the rural Midwest before moving to the DC area where I actually grew up.
Speaking of fathers, I don't know if you know, do you know the story of Miss Sherrard's father?
I do. Vaguely.
Yeah, so her father, when she was a teenager, she grew up in deep south Georgia, I think in Albany, or a town or city near Albany, Georgia, which is really close to the Georgia-Florida line. They owned several hundreds of acres of farmland in Georgia, and her father was murdered by a white farmer over disputes of cows being on one side of the property land or another. So I'm not sure if she witnessed her father being shot, but essentially after that, she dedicated her life to civil rights in terms of black farmers. She went on to Antioch College in Yellow Springs. Some people may or may not know. Coretta Scott King graduated from there, a very liberal university. Is that Colorado? But anyway, so do you think that Miss Sherrard's life experiences and what happened? She was very, let me say this. She was very humble in all of the interviews, seemed very grounded. And very forgiving of a lot of people. How do you think her early life experience and the way she reacted to this incident meshed together?
I mean, I would say, basing this quite a bit off of personal experience, my parents' personal experience, what I saw out of them and also what I learned from them just through the course of growing up, even though they were often the targets of hate and they came from a place of relative oppression, it didn't translate into outward anger. In fact, it often translated into compassion for other people, for understanding of other people's plights. And also, I think importantly, it translated into a lot of composure. And I'd have to say that that's similar to what Sherrard displayed in this case. She seemed composed throughout, not just humble, but composed. Maybe like she wasn't entirely surprised.
She also was very frank about a lot of things. And the question that I have is, do you think she was frank with President Obama? Because if I'm not mistaken, on Thursday or Friday, she did talk to him on the phone. And do you think she had a real conversation with him about the need for him to use this incident as a way to talk about race in America? Or did she skip over that?
That's tough. I don't know what to say. It's tough for me to think that she would have counseled him on how to discuss race in America. I would applaud her if she did do that, but it's tough for me to make that leap and say that she did.
We actually have a video clip of Ms. Sherrard. I think on Friday she was on The View with all the ladies with Gab Fist.
That sounds dangerous.
So we're going to play a brief clip of that.
You know, we had just shown a clip where at the tail end of it, you say, we endured 8 years of the Bushes and we didn't do the stuff these Republicans are doing because we have a black president. Second part of my question was, doesn't the Hatch Act prohibit civil servants from making partisan and political statements? So isn't that reason enough to look into, okay, is this something even legal going on, you know?
You know, maybe the Hatch Act would have been meant only for me, because I don't know of any government official who was gagged, especially during the Bush administration, and kept from being able to speak out.
It's a very tough.
Also, the fact that, let me just,
maybe it's something that's loosely followed.
But I wanted to support what Shirley said before, which is that during the Bush administration, you had tax cuts for the wealthiest. And he did not, that whole administration did not give a damn about poor people, and everybody knows it. That's why Obama was elected in the first place. I mean, even now, the Republicans are blocking an extension of unemployment insurance, and yet they're okay with tax cuts to the wealthy. Let me finish. So now you have Obama in office, and he does give a damn about black people.
Is it black, white, or is it rich, poor?
Well,
which is it? Be honest, if it's black, white, or rich,
poor. Poor because they were black.
Exactly.
I understand that, too.
Exactly.
Then it is about race. I mean, we're supposed to be post-racial here, but we're really not.
There is no post-racial yet. This was a media idea that sounded great.
It did.
It sounded wonderful. But the truth is, this is the first time these issues of race have ever come up in this way, because there has never been a black president before. So people are now trying to figure out how they feel, how they deal, how they talk. This is a new world for us.
So you were just listening to the ladies on The View talk to me. Ms. Sherrar, she barely said anything. It's actually a whole, it's actually a longer interview. You can go on. It's amazing. Out of all the things that I've seen, I really like her on The View because she stood her ground. So race, food, and politics definitely were all into play with the Sherrar thing. You had black farmers, you had everything that people are scared to talk about. And there continues to be an intersection, and Americans are missing the boat on having a dialogue with some action behind it. What is your advice for a person listening to the show on how to solve or engage in some of these conversations in their own community around race and food?
Tough question. I would say a few things. Number one, I would say don't fool yourself and don't distance yourself from our history. I caught myself, and this is interesting since we're talking about the USDA, I caught myself watching the Olympics in South Africa, where it was very visible and very much talked about on media telecasts how blacks had been stripped of land in South Africa, a little bit more recently than here, and a little bit more blatantly than here, but it happened here all the same. And because my research, which I think we're going to speak about in a minute, has very much to do about urban blacks in the 20th century, I can't help but think about how stripping people of land and in fact making it very difficult for them to use their skills that they developed since being in this country in terms of producing food, stripping them of the ability essentially to be food producers, puts them in a position where they've then got to go to the city.
Right. Exactly.
And that's the start of a lot of communities in the Northeast. A start from basically being disadvantaged, disempowered, and in fact, if you can't produce food, the more difficult it is for you to produce food, then the more you've got to rely on an industrialized food system.
Totally. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back with the more food, culture, race with Damon Yen Mosley. Keep listening.
Some people say we got a lot of malice. Some say it's a lot of nerve. Get what we deserve. We've been duped and we've been scorned. We've been treated bad, talked about as sure as you born. Just as sure as it takes 2 eyes to make a pair. Brother, we can't quit until we get our share.
Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Check out our program schedule and show archives on heritageradionetwork.com.
We're chatting with Damian Mosley. Mr. Mosley is a NYU food studies doctoral candidate. In 2008, he moved to Baltimore, where he never was able to stay out of the kitchen. He wasn't able to stay out of the kitchen for long. He began working in a restaurant and running a catering operation and launched a biscuit stand at the Highland Town Farmers Market. I have to ask. I think that's the coolest thing. The biscuit stand. Do tell.
It's kind of serendipity, actually. I was consulting for a farmers market, trying to help them to grow the market, expand it. And I was suggesting to them actually to do food demonstrations. If you're going to be in Southeast Baltimore, the hood, poor black, poor white, poor Latino people, if you're going to bring them rutabaga or celery root and hope that they buy it, you know, have some sort of demonstration, something to engage them. And I was set up to do that, and the market manager called me a week before the market opened and asked if I would instead consider being a permanent vendor. She thought it would be a more consistent draw to the market, and next thing we knew, biscuit sandwiches.
Okay, so you're doing only biscuit sandwiches there?
At the market. Well, biscuit sandwiches, and then I do sweeter biscuits. So, peach biscuits, plum biscuits.
Wow. Sounds amazing. Where are our biscuits? You should have brought me some biscuits. I love biscuits.
True. I should have brought some.
So you're here. You live in Baltimore, but obviously you lived in New York before, and you are doing research around food and race at NYU. You're working on your dissertation. Do tell about some of your research there. And actually, I found out about you over a year ago. You're in Gastropolis.
Right.
Gastropolis. Wow. You know, I'll screw something up in a minute.
It's a tough one.
Yeah. I read about you. You have a chapter in there titled Uptown Manhattan Food Culture. That's probably the wrong name, but about food culture in Harlem.
Right.
How did you find out? How were you asked to do this chapter entitled Cooking Up Heritage in Harlem?
This is actually going back several years. I was asked to do some sort of chapter about food, preferably black food in New York. And one thing I was most interested in was just in historically black neighborhoods that are slowly being changed demographically. I wondered, how do the food businesses, how do they survive? Are they forced to move further uptown or further away from that neighborhood as their clientele that they were originally intending to serve? As that clientele moves, do they move, or are they in fact appreciated by new residents who are looking for something seemingly authentic, something gritty, something of that neighborhood? And so this started from that, but evolved into a bigger project, which is my dissertation.
So what are your thoughts on all of, I rarely go to Harlem, actually, but when I do go there and when I read the blogs, there's always a new something that's being built there. Target yesterday, new restaurants from high-end celebrity chefs. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, realistically, even as plenty of people feel like they would love for those larger businesses, those mainstream sort of chain businesses, not to infiltrate a place like Harlem, there are plenty of residents in Harlem who do actually feel like they've got a need for those places and who want those places to open. So, I mean, you've got two sides to that coin, of course.
You also, you've written quite a few articles, and you did one in The Root. You write a lot about race and food. What are your thoughts about the lack of folks of color in food media in general, or either documenting the places that we eat, or what's currently going on in terms of food activism and urban ag?
I'll be honest with you. I don't feel like you have to be a person of color to document the food ways of people of color. I just feel like typically foodways, food culture of the African diaspora is very much slighted in the culinary world. You know, I went to culinary school, and the teaching, the textbooks, the curriculum is very Eurocentric, and in some cases for good reason. I in fact, when some of my peers, those who could afford to, when some of them traveled, say, to France or to Italy, I did an internship in West Africa, just cooking in a hotel for that exact reason.
Wow, amazing.
Because I wanted to see something different. Now, I was in Francophone West Africa. I was still learning some French techniques, but in a different setting, in a Muslim city, in, you know, a black West African city. And so I felt like I was seeing more of a Creolized experience than a mainstream European experience.
Cool. I wish we had more. You have to come back. I mean, I love to have these scholars on Hot Grease to break it down. Dr. Frederick Opie, you know him. He's been on the show before. He does a lot in terms of food ways. Jessica B. Harris, I have to get her on the show. Absolutely. Definitely. Love her.
But she lives right down the street, too.
So. Yeah, so I have to get her on the show soon. So I want to thank you for joining us on Hot Grease. And folks, if they want to check you out and come visit Baltimore or some of the other work that you're doing in New York City, how can my listeners reach out to you or find you?
One of the best ways, actually, is on Facebook. I have, in the last year, started a company with a very good friend of mine who's from New York, from the Bronx. We started a company called Black Sauce Kitchen. And rather than always writing about food and race, we make food that's near and dear to our experience. And we do the farmers market in Baltimore. We cater a number of festivals, and we do private catering. And we just try to always have interesting food, usually inspired in the American South or the Caribbean.
So, folks, if you want to check out Damian Mosley, go to Facebook or do a Google search, Black Sauce Kitchen, and you can find him there. Damian, thank you for joining us on Hot Grease.
Thank you very much for having me.
Listeners, stay tuned. Type and Tell up next. To Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. Hot Grease is produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Nat Wiener. This program is being sponsored by White Oak Pastures, the wonderful Will Harris. For more information on White Oak Pastures, go to whiteoakpastures.com. Let me give a Southern Girl's hug to Roberta's Restaurant, located at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, New York. The location of two sustainable shipping containers known as Heritage Radio Network. Remember show and tell in grade school? Here on Hot Grease, we have the grown-up version, Type and Tell. We shout out the latest food-centric discovery, and listeners do the talking. Type and tell everyone about Danny Macaroons. Dan Cohen, welcome to Hot Grease.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So you know I'm in love with your, you know, caramel macaroons.
I didn't know you were in love.
You knew, right? So you brought them. What's the inspiration? Because you have a very unique story. You came from sports.
Yeah, from running a social sports media startup. The inspiration. Well, these are coconut macaroons. These aren't French macaroons. These are straight up, shredded coconut macaroons. And I've been baking them for a long time. I mean, you know, in sort of Jewish tradition, it's kind of a Passover thing because you can't eat the flour and you know, the stuff that rises. And so macaroons are a dessert that sort of fit in with the rules and regulations of such holidays.
So you've been making these for quite some time.
It's been probably, 8 years or something like that.
Oh, wow.
And
so you mentioned French versus regular. Do you just call them regular? What's the difference between French macaroons and coconut ones?
I call them coconut macaroons. So macaroons, essentially are, you know, a cookie that's, that uses nut flour or nut as the main ingredient, as opposed to a wheat flour. And so in these macaroons, in coconut macaroons, you've got coconut as the main sort of dry ingredient. In French macaroons, you've got, you know, typically almond flour, though, you know, you can use pistachio flour, walnut flour, whatever you want, whatever kind of nut you want to use. And egg whites, and those are sort of the two main ingredients in any kind of macaroon. French macaroons are, you know, the little sandwich ones, and coconut macaroons are typically sort of mounds, if we want to sort of associate them with the candy bar, but you know, mounds or you know, lumps of coconut.
So we were talking Harlem earlier with Mr. Mosley, and you actually live in East Harlem.
I do.
And you mentioned making macaroons in East Harlem.
So I live and bake up in Spanish Harlem, north of 116. And you know, Damien was talking about the shifting demographics of Harlem, and I think that I am sort of representative in some ways of the changing demographics up there. And you know, I think there's opportunity there in Harlem because the cost of living is a bit cheaper, rent is cheaper. There are spaces available where you can cook, where you can open up a storefront. Now, I don't have a storefront, but I bake up there, and my opportunity to do that, to bake, to find a place, a commercial kitchen where I could sort of legally do all this, was up there. And I sell in the community. I sell to coffee shops up in Spanish Harlem as well as the rest of the city. But I think that as we see this evolution of what Harlem looks like, in some ways, I think it looks like Danny Macaroons.
Ah, brown on the top and kind of yellow on the bottom.
That's
huh?
Right.
Okay. Well, I can dig that. So pairings for macaroons? Would you just say all coffee? What should people, is this a morning treat or is this a snack? Because I'm about to have a bite.
Well, it depends. Obviously, it depends on who you are. But when I started this, right, the whole reason that I started doing this, other than the fact that I had been baking them, I mean, why go into business? Well, I had a crazy, I don't even know what she's called, great aunt-in-law, maybe, my like uncle's wife's mother, who was telling me that I should sell them. And eventually I sort of brought them around to some coffee shops and they bought in and thought that, you know, they could sell them to their customers. But I started really doing this because it sort of grew out of the frustration of going to coffee shops, drinking an espresso, a small coffee, and seeing these giant pastries in the cases that were sort of my only option to eat. And it's a little espresso. It's an ounce and a half or an ounce of coffee. And what are you going to do with a muffin that's, you know, the size of a softball or a grapefruit?
I mean,
it's just too much food. So so I started making these macaroons and biscotti and scones also. And then make them sort of reasonably sized so that you can eat them with a small cup of coffee. They're done when you're done with your coffee. And it's not this you're not eating another meal. It's not 500 calories worth of food. So so for me, they go with a cup of coffee, with a normal size coffee. If you're going to have a 32-ounce Starbucks massive thing.
Starbucks. Oh, we can't say Starbucks. No. Oh, you know, we're all about local and high.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Then this might not be for you. But if you're going in, if you appreciate a cup of coffee, if you appreciate a little espresso, then this is the kind of thing that pairs really well. However, I just brought some to a friend of mine who had it with a glass of wine, who had one of the chocolate-covered ones with a glass of wine, a glass of red wine, and she said it went really well. So can you pair them with wine? Yeah, I suppose you can. I think they're more of an afternoon thing, but, you know, you can eat them. They're probably the salted caramel. Maybe salted caramel goes really well with beer.
So speaking of local coffee shops, where are you located in New York City? Where can we find your macaroons?
Well, seeing as where are we in Bushwick here?
We're in Bushwick.
Take the L two stops towards Manhattan. Get off in Williamsburg, and I'm at Gimme Coffee in Williamsburg. I'm at Gimme Coffee in Manhattan. The Barnyard Cheese Shop in Alphabet City, Piata in Midtown. Spaha up in Spanish Harlem, Love Cafe also up in Spanish Harlem on Pleasant Ave. So
you're blowing up, huh?
You know where the Mac Danny Macaroons is around town. I'm in about 8 shops now, and I've got a bunch more scheduled to come on board in the fall. And you know.
And so you have beyond the macaroons, you slightly mentioned the scones and the biscotti, right?
Scones and biscotti, and the scones and biscotti came to be, you know. Damien mentioned serendipity. I was in a coffee shop. They asked if I baked anything else. I said, not really, or nothing that I'm going to tell you that I bake, but if there's something else that you want, I can work on it. And they said, well, if you made biscotti, we'd sell them. So I came back a week later with some pistachio biscotti, and they thought they were really good and started selling them. And the same thing happened with scones. Somebody said, you know, I'd love to have some scones. I can't find any that I really like. I said, give me a week. I brought scones back a week later. They really liked them. And now scones are in a bunch of different shops, too. So it's the menu is constantly evolving. I've got turnovers, I think, some fruit turnovers that are about to launch. This week is a big test week. And, you know, we roll out stuff as people request.
Cool. So you're all over social media. You're on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter, Danny Macaroons. Facebook.com/Danny Macaroons. What else am I on?
You have a regular website
somewhere.
You're on Foursquare, because I'm on Foursquare. I see you on Foursquare. So, you know, if you're listening, 9 times out of 10, if you're listening on the computer, you're probably, you love social media, right? Maybe listeners. So type and tell everyone about Danny Macaroons.
DannyMacaroons.com.
Dan Cohen. Well, now maybe I'll start calling you Danny, huh?
You can call me Danny. You can call
me
Danny Macaroons. You can call me Steve if you want.
Oh, okay, Steve. Okay. Thank you for joining us on Hot Grease.
Thanks so much.
I already had a bite. I can't wait to have my pizza and have the salted caramel macaroons, my favorite. Thanks for joining us, and we look forward to you coming back with scones and biscotti.
Anytime.
Have a great week. Listeners, thank you again for listening to Hot Grease. Join me every Monday at 3:30 on Heritage Radio Network. Until then, always take the road less traveled.